probably what we're gonna have.
Good morning. I'm going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We have a number of bills here. We do have some issues that have come up on a couple of them, new amendments that are coming in. And because of that, we're going to be kind of jumping around on our schedule that we have today to try to accommodate individual members that need to or would like to come in to testify and also have one of the amendments. So on Senate Bill 385, I understand that we have an amendment that's just got posted. And so we're going to see if we can hold off on that one until close to 9 when the amendment will be there so we can actually take more testimony and it will be in line with what our rules are. With that said, we're going to go ahead and start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 446. Well, I'll tell you, before we do that, Senator Boquist, you have a couple, three bills here, and 446 was not one of them, correct? I think what I'm going to, and I'm assuming you've got other duties that you need to be getting to. So let me do this. We're going to, out of courtesy, we do this for the people who are listening, for members to be able to go to their other committee assignments and other work obligations. I'm going to go ahead and open up for the purpose of taking testimony from Senator Boquist, Senate Bill 170, Senate Bill 173, and Senate Bill 636. We will not go into the reading of each of those. We'll go over the reading when we take the rest of the testimony. Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Brian Boquist, Senate District 12. The three bills that are before you, just for the record, are constituent bills. Sometimes I get beat up, but I have a very interesting district, and I follow very closely to one of those sections of the Constitution, since the Chief Justice is sitting to my right rear here, that says, you know, we're the avenue of redress, and so I get beat up on both sides of every single issue, because if a constituent comes forward and has an issue and they haven't had it addressed by the legislature, then I bring it forward. I'm going to confine my comments, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, actually specifically. The other two constituent bills are here. There's people to testify, but to Senate Bill 170. Senate Bill 170 was brought to my attention by a young lady named Rebecca McKinley, who had thought she was going to be here. The good chair was kind enough to bring this bill forward for a public hearing, and it is about gun safety. The reason I decided to come down here and testify, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is that this young lady's bill came through two mock legislatures, and then she brought it to our attention and wanted to have it brought before the Oregon legislature, specifically the state Senate. The bill is a very simple concept, contrary to popular belief. The bill is basically addresses the issue of having gun safety education. Her bill, unfortunately, in my opinion, and I stated this here and I'm quoted in the newspaper, said, you know, we should bring a gun into the classroom in schools and so that students would know what that is and avoid it. There's a series of gun safety programs out there that do not do that. And here's the issue that she really brought forward, and I think I'm going to just read a couple little short lines. You have the testimony of hers beforehand, but I do want to read into the record one or two lines so that it's clear what everybody was talking about in terms of this piece of legislation. And again, I'm reading off the testimony that I think is going to be up on OLIS at some point or is up there now because I haven't checked recently in the last 10 minutes. And this is from Rebecca McKinley. And she said, I'm a high school senior, and my senator, Senator Boquist, recently introduced a bill based on an idea I had. And then she goes through and explains what I just explained for her. I want to go down to the middle of it and just state one thing. The primary reason I wrote this bill was hopefully to prevent some of the tragedies we hear about in the news, where young people are fascinated with guns, somehow acquire one, and misuse it. And that is the intent of the bill. The bill is to stop, whether you support or oppose some of these other bills, whether you're for or against background checks, whether you're for or against guns, is her statement, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is somehow acquire one and misuse it. And that was her intent across the board. It is unfortunate she's been, as a high school student, been beat up in some newspapers. We've seen some pretty, as we all see on this particular issue, some pretty hateful email in regards to her bill and her personal state because she brought this bill forward. But I would hope that in the future, not necessarily today, that we as the legislature look around and say, regardless of what we do in the issue and agree and disagree on firearms registration and everything else, but the single most important issue is safety. And this young lady's key concept was just to prevent individuals from picking up a gun that was lost or sitting somewhere, as we've seen so many times, and doing something tragic with it. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will go back to working on taxes and let your committee work on judiciary. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any questions? I'm assuming not. Senator, thank you very much. So we're going to go ahead and recess those three bills for, at this point, Senate Bill 170, Senate Bill 173, and Senate Bill 636, and come back for additional public testimony. And we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing, which will be for Senate Bill 446. Mara?
Yes. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 446 comes to us at the request of Chief Justice Thomas Ballmer and the Oregon Circuit Court Judges Association. We have no revenue impact on this bill, and we have an indeterminate fiscal. We do have a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. The bill is ready to move today. There are no amendments before us either. And I believe committee members are very familiar with the conversation that's been ongoing in regarding judges' salaries. So, for example, a January 2014 judicial salary survey conducted by the National Center for State Courts ranks Oregon judges as follows, adjusted for 2015 increase. The Oregon Supreme Court judges are 44th out of 51 jurisdictions, including the District of Columbia. Oregon Court of Appeals, 32nd out of 39 jurisdictions. And it's good to note that the Oregon Court of Appeals is also consistently ranks as one of the busiest appellate courts in the nation. And circuit courts, judges rank 41st out of 51 jurisdictions on pay, including the District of Columbia. Senate Bill 446 then increases judicial salaries for judges of the Oregon Supreme Court, the Oregon Court of Appeals, the Oregon Tax Court, and Oregon Circuit Courts on an annual basis when the cost of living increase per the Consumer Price Index. The bill requires the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court to make cost of living increase determinations annually before July 1st. If the cost of living increased in the previous calendar year, the Chief Justice must multiply judges' salaries by the percentage determined. Senate Bill 446 makes adjusted salaries effective July 1st of the year in which the adjustment is made and requires the first adjustment to be made on July 1st, 2016.
Well, thank you. Chief Justice Ballmer, you're here. I have two other judges. Would you like for them to come up at the same time?
Yeah, let's move to
So, Judge Marshall and then Judge Stauffer. Thank you all very much for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tom Ballmer. I'm the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. The way we look at this is that in order to move forward and make any progress, real progress on judicial compensation, we've got to stop moving backwards. And the fact is, because our salaries are set by statute, we move backwards every year. In fact, if you took what the judges were getting in 1974 and adjusted it just for inflation, no sort of actual cost of no actual increase, but just keeping up with inflation, we'd be making about $25,000 a year more than we are now. We didn't have an increase for 5 years until the legislature in 2013 provided a salary increase, but that was essentially catching up for about 5 years of cost of living. So this bill would allow the sort of cost of living increases that most state and many private sector employees get, and then we would be sort of on an even playing field. We would be getting our compensation adjusted for inflation, and then the legislature could decide as a policy matter whether it was appropriate to make sort of real increases beyond the cost of living. So that's basically what this bill would do, and I'd urge the committee to give it a due pass recommendation and forward the bill to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you.
I'm Janet Stauffer. I'm a circuit court judge. I have a 5-courthouse jurisdiction. So I am in Wasco, Hood River, Sherman, Wheeler, and Gillam counties with 3 other judges. I'm also a member of the Circuit Court Judges Association Executive Committee. And we have several other members here. Did you want to introduce them at this point?
Yes, so we've got Judge James, Mary James from Marion County, and then Judge Paula Brownhill from Clatsop County.
I was trying to figure out how to word this. I think it must be very awkward for Justice Ballmer, the chief of our Oregon Supreme Court, to come here and ask for more money every year. And I think that COLA helps with that. If we can get our salaries to a place where we can not continue to move backward year after year. Certainly the COLA bill will assist in that. We have been here year after year, I think, for a while. I just spoke with one of the retired judges that's been working in our courthouse, and he said over the last 20 or 25 years that traditionally we'll get a raise, we'll be there, and then we backslide for 5 or 6 years because of this lack of a COLA. If we had the COLA, then at least we're going to be on par year after year once we get our salary to the place where it should be. Looking forward, it is important that we have salaries and the COLA will keep us there, that will keep retain judges who come to the bench and people that are qualified and that we can match with the private and public sector salaries so that once somebody comes in that they're willing to stay. We are all family people. I've got 3 kids in college, and when you're a judge, you can't just go out and drum up a little bit more business. We need to have our...
We drum up more business, but we don't get more
right,
compensation
get more
for it.
I can't go sign up more clients because I happen to have 3 kids in college. So it's a good way to keep us, I think, and it's fair. Most people, I think, in the private sector at least, do have this protection against backsliding. And I think it's appropriate for the judicial branch, especially the judges in the judicial branch, to have that. I think the rest of our branch does have that.
And Mr. Chair and other members of the committee, I'm Judge Chris Marshall from Multnomah County, and I'm the current president of the Circuit Court Judges Association, and we, along with the Chief Justice, are urging a due pass and move this bill onto the Ways and Means Committee. We're simply asking for a cost of living adjustment that I think most of the members of the public already assume that we get. When you talk to people about this and you tell them, well, I'm going down to Salem for this particular bill, they say to you, what? That doesn't already happen. We assume that would happen. And so you tell them, no, that it doesn't. And so we're just asking that in order for future years, we don't have to be coming every legislative session and bringing the same issue before good folks like you to just allow this cost of living adjustment to occur when it's appropriate in the economic situation of what's happening in our state here. So we don't think there's any opposition to this that we've heard from anybody. And if you look at the letters of testimony and support, broad-based support from all facets of people involved in the legal industry, and we're unaware that there'd be any opposition that we've heard of from anybody else. And just wanted to bring up one thing that I brought up last time we were here talking about the salary issue. And it's interesting when you talk to the young people now in the law schools or even in the colleges and high schools who are thinking about legal profession and jobs in the legal profession, and they ask you, what would you recommend? What do I need to do? I'm interested in being a judge. And as I mentioned last time, it's really difficult to not tell them, well, in Oregon, it's probably not the best place for you to be a judge and have that be a career goal. There's, many other places where if you're trying to make a living and have this as your career and support a family, unfortunately, Oregon's not the best place for you to be. I don't want to have to say that. I think that we have a very solid judiciary. I think people recognize that around the country, and all we're asking is that we be compensated fairly so that we can continue to attract the people that are going to serve the state well and continue the fine traditions that we've had of quality in the judiciary. So we thank you very much for listening to us and urge a due pass.
Thank you very much. Is there any questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Thatcher?
No, just an emphasis on the fact that we do need to attract and retain competent, experienced judges, and I really think that's very important.
Well, thank you for that comment. So if there's no others, thank you all very much for coming forward. Let me ask, these were the only 3 that were signed up for giving testimony. Is there anyone else in the room today who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 446? Not seeing anyone stepping up. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing. And I understand we have the paperwork ready to go for it, so we're going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 446.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 446 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 446 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and also with the referral and subsequent referral, I should say, to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And we'll go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 446. And at this point, we're going to change out counsel. So as I said, we're going to need to move around on the public hearing schedule because of availability of individuals and other situations. So we're going to go ahead and open up. Next public hearing will be on Senate Bill 315.
Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 315 states that a person engaged in a business of selling a used firearm may either use a manual or an electronic transfer register. The bill provides that the register must be approved by the Department of State Police and mandates that the electronic register be provided in hard copy to a federal agency within 20 hours of request. There are no amendments on this bill.
All right, thank you. We have three individuals that are set to give testimony, at least they're signed up at this point. Danielle Romaine and Josh Aller, and okay, we'll just do the y'all two first, and it looks like we have another person who wants to testify on this one too.
Thank you, Chair Brzozinski and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Danielle Romaine, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Pawnbrokers Association. And I have Josh Oler with me from Silver Lining Pawn to actually talk about what we're talking about in the bill. But basically, this is a very simple bill. It's meant to help us go paperless. It talks about the register. When a firearm is transferred, we have to enter certain information into a register about the person and about the gun. And this allows for electronic transferring of that information to law enforcement. We cleared the bill with OSP and ATF during the interim, so we don't expect any opposition to the bill. There are no known opponents, and it should be fairly simple. So with that, I'll let Josh speak to how this actually works in practice.
Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee, my name is Josh Oler. I'm a owner of Silver Lining Jewelry and Loan Company. I also serve on the board of the Oregon Pawnbrokers Association. I wanted to just explain very quickly that the bill that we put forth here, this was brought up to us actually a few years ago by a fluke, where they realized when ATF was doing an audit of a store, they realized that there was this transfer of firearm form, which is a paper transfer form, which every store has to fill out every time a firearm comes into the store. Most state licensed pawn shops were not filling this out because we were already doing the same information electronically to the local jurisdictions that monitored us. When we started filling this form out and giving it to those jurisdictions, the jurisdictions then called us back to say, what are we supposed to do with this paper? It seems like a lot of these papers just get filed in the round circular. Or no one knows what to do with these pieces of paper. So we took it upon ourselves to try to work with OSP, ATF, and figure out a way to get rid of this form for those who already are doing it electronically. For those that do not do this electronically, we don't want to force them to get the computer and spend the money to do it electronically, so they would have the opportunity to still fill this out, as per statute. But for us to fill it out electronically, we don't need to fill this out. The only issue that ATF had on this, which we were able to put in, was that if an agent were to show up at a business and they wanted a paper form of this, that we'd be able to provide that for them. And that's where we put in that we'd be able to provide that for them within 20 hours or 24 hours so that if there wasn't a manager on site that didn't know how to punch the keystrokes in, that somebody would be able to get that to them. What I did bring was the actual copy of the form, which we keep in our records, versus what we are already turning in every single day to law enforcement that shows the exact same information on it. As a business, we have a huge responsibility with privacy information and keeping that information private. So that's the only reason I have stuff blacked out on this piece of paper is the person's name and identification numbers. However, we are a heavily regulated industry. We actually are not opposed to regulation. We are governed under 13 different federal charters as far as our business is concerned and deal with multiple agencies. We don't push anything through, any bills through without working with these agencies to make sure that we're all on the same page with this. And we've always taken great pride in working with Romaine's, working with the state, working with their different agencies at our meeting to make sure that this is what everyone thinks is right. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Thatcher?
Excuse me, thanks. You showed me at the very beginning, you showed a form. Yeah, that little thing. Is that something that by statute, that Oregon statute that you're required to fill out, or is that a federal thing?
No, it's actually, it's an Oregon statute. Form is 125-5180, and it's governed under the ATF because in the ATF's manual of how to actually deal with the firearm transactions in Oregon, this is actually written into their manual. So ATF, the only reason ATF federally says that we have to do this is because the Oregon statute in firearms says that we have to do that, if that makes sense.
And Senator Thatcher, the site is 166-427, the ORS that mandates that.
Oh, sorry.
And it's for each and every single firearm?
Yep. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, if in the business that we have in pawnbroking, which is our main business, most of our customers are bringing in their own personal firearm for safe storage. To get a loan against that firearm, we hold the firearm. They come back, they pick up their own firearm. We release it back to them. Per federal statute, that's still considered a transfer of a firearm, so we fill out the same paperwork every single time on that, just like they're buying a brand new gun. If that gun then comes back in to the store, we fill out the same paperwork again, submit that all in again, just like it was a singular transaction. A lot of our customers are repeat customers. They come in over and over, especially during when hunting season's on. They pick up their firearms. When it's done, they come back into the store. So we're filling out on particular customers. We're probably filling out at least a half a dozen of these per year for the exact same gun for the exact same customer. It just seems like it's a lot of wasted paperwork. It's wasted time for the store because we have to hand fill these out again. We keep these records indefinitely as any firearm record, pretty much. So it just seems like a very simple way if we're already submitting this electronically to the law enforcement.
Other questions or comments? All right. Thank you all very much.
Thanks.
So our next two witnesses, Alex Kyler and Roger Beyer.
Chairman Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. We've looked at Senate Bill 315 pretty closely. We really don't have a position on it, but it does represent a unique opportunity for the committee, I think, to consider at least a potential amendment for this measure. The testimony that you heard earlier is absolutely spot on. Police agencies do have a lot of these pieces of paper, and strapped agencies like the Lane County Sheriff's Agency finds it tough to take those pieces of paper and then upload them into the state database, which is a database developed by the city of Portland and which local agencies pay into. The issue for us is that cities and counties were preempted from regulating the sale of used firearms back in 1995. There was a little carve out, however, of that preemption that allows cities to continue to regulate the purchase of used firearms by pawn shops and secondhand stores. The problem is it only says cities. And so where you have a pawn shop or a secondhand store in an unincorporated area, this law cannot take effect because the ordinance that's prescribed in the bill may not be written by a county. And in fact, we had this situation in Lane County where a store moved out of the city of Junction City and into the unincorporated area of Lane County and then came to our board, and we'd actually had some language in our code regulating the sale of used firearms, and essentially they pointed out that it was illegal for us to have that into our code. The Board of County Commissioners subsequently repealed it. But the concern from the sheriff is that we do have an opportunity here for, unfortunately, a transaction of a stolen gun to go unnoticed by the database, primarily due to the resource issue. And that's what I think is really important in the bill, is that this provides, through a city ordinance, that a store may upload that directly into the database, which is clearly, in our opinion, a good policy. The fact is, however, the preemption was not lifted for counties.
Roger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer, here representing the NRA. The bill is drafted. We have no objection to or support thereof. The question, and I think it was raised by Senator Thatcher, is that this seems to be an antiquated statute and maybe should just be repealed altogether, and it is completely unnecessary because federal law already requires the used gun dealers to check the guns against the database to make sure they're not stolen firearms. This statute, I don't know what the origin of it is, but it seems to predate the federal acts that now require that. The other question we have on it is what happens to the records of these used firearms after they are checked and shown not to be stolen? I don't see anywhere where the law enforcement agency is required to destroy them like they are in the state system under state background checks, where the law only allows the records to be kept for a maximum of 5 years. So that is a concern under this statute. What happens to all these paper or electronic records once the gun is shown to be okay? And it just seems like it could eliminate the entire statute and it wouldn't affect anything from my reading. So with that, offer that testimony. I have to answer any questions.
All right. Let me ask if there's a question. I want to follow up on what Rogers was putting on the record. But so have you had discussions with state police as to taking one of those steps? I'm not sure as to whether it would be appropriate to just outright abolish the statute. I'm not sure what the cross-check is that under the federal system that's required. So that's something, you know, we would want to look at. But I'm also wondering if on the portion of when those records are in fact made, it sounds like from the previous witness, Mr. Aller, that they keep theirs into perpetuity. And I don't know what that means as to how long, or what happens for the ones that go to local law enforcement. So have you done any research or discussions on that?
Mr. Chair, I have not had any discussions with the state police or the local police on that. I believe it is correct that the gun dealers are required to keep their records on transactions, on transfers. But under state law, the state police are not required or not allowed to keep their records beyond the five-year period.
Right.
This statute, as I read it, has no limitations on the records at the local law enforcement of whether or not they can or shall or may keep those records. It's silent to that issue, so I have no idea what they're doing with them today. I think the last witness said that they're round filing them. That may be with the case. I have no knowledge.
Okay. Well, that's something we'd have to look into before we take any action on that. So I have one other person that does want to give testimony. It appears Tim Cowan. Sir, why don't you come up? While he's coming up, is there anyone else who would like to give testimony on Senate Bill? Kevin, why don't you come on up? Oops. And besides Mr. Sterik, is there anyone else? All right. So, Tim, why don't you go ahead?
Sir, just to see if it's appropriate, I didn't get a chance to testify the other day. I was on a list, but it just took too long. Can I do that now, or would it be appropriate to?
That record has been closed on Senate Bill 941, is what I'm assuming.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Then I guess so, I'll.
Senate Bill 315 is what we have before us at this point.
Is it, okay, 315?
Yeah. Yeah, you've asked to give testimony on the one that we just heard testimony.
Then so I'll pass, sir.
You'll pass?
Yes, I guess so, if it's already been through committee.
Yeah, the record was open until their vote out of the committee, which was on Monday morning, if I remember correctly. So that bill, if it should go forward through the Senate, it will go to the House side. There will be an opportunity there because it will go through another substantive committee, at least that's my understanding, and there will be public hearings at that time.
I'll wait then, sir.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time. Kevin.
For the record, Kevin Starrett, Oregon Farmers Federation. Mr. Beyer covered most of the points, but I want to let you know that this particular statute, as he pointed out, it apparently predates our background check system completely. And currently, when guns are brought into gun stores, they are checked by OSP against the stolen gun list. I don't think there's any federal requirement for that. But many of the gun dealers that I know aren't even aware that this statute exists and don't follow this, because it's really quite obscure. And as previous witnesses said, when these records arrive with the police, they often have no idea what to do with them. So as far as staying in line with federal statute, I do not believe that there's any conflict there. I just think that this is kind of the vestigial organ of statutes where many people are not using it, and the people who are using it, that's not really necessary, because what they're trying to find out, which is are the guns stolen, is already handled, because they are required when a gun comes into their inventory that it does not come from a distributor, that it comes as a used gun, to check it against the stolen guns list.
Okay. It just seems to me that we need to do a little bit more work just to cross the T's and dot the I's before we start taking those type of actions as to abolishing it until we know exactly what is required. And I appreciate your testimony on that. Any questions? Thank you all very much. So, again, I'll ask just to see if anyone else wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 315. If not, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing at this point. And we're going to move to Senate Bill 173 and open up a public hearing on it.
Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 173 comes to us from Senator Boquist. The bill authorizes a person who is licensed with a concealed carry permit to present a valid concealed carry permit to a peace officer in lieu of presenting the firearm for inspection. We have no amendments on this bill.
All right. And for the record, we're actually just reopening Senate Bill 173 public hearing, since we did open it up previously this morning for Senator Boquist. This will be our first testimony since he waived his statements on that. So, Kevin Hall?
That's correct.
Mr. Hall, thank you very much. If you'll give us your name for the record, and then go ahead and give us your testimony.
All right. My name is Kevin Hall. I'm from Monroe, Oregon. Senator Brzozinski, members of the committee. I'm from autumn of 2012 to spring of 2013. I was involved in a civil rights lawsuit against a police officer in Corvallis, Oregon, who had unlawfully detained me outside my home. During this lawsuit, I was called to a deposition in Corvallis, which took place in a public building. Upon entering this building, the officer, which I was suing, asked if I was armed, and I indicated I was. He told me he was going to utilize ORS 166.380 to have another officer inspect my concealed firearm, despite the fact that he knew I had a valid Oregon concealed handgun license. He called two officers to the building, one of which, Lieutenant Todd Bailey, demanded to inspect my weapon. I offered to show my CHL to him to prevent him to have to handle a loaded weapon in a public building. He declined. He removed my firearm from its holster, and while a round was still in the chamber, pointed the gun across the city street toward an occupied building and a parking lot. It's clear to me that these officers not only harassed me because I was suing one of their own, but endangered the lives of nearby citizens. SB 173 seeks to remedy the situation occurring again. It simply allows for a CHL holder to show their license to carry a concealed handgun in lieu of having their weapon inspected. I cannot think of a legitimate reason for a loaded handgun to be inspected in a public building where there are often many people that could be injured by careless officers like the Corvallis lieutenant who harassed me. I've submitted written testimony to this committee with the URL for my video that has recorded this incident. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Before you leave, let me ask if there's any questions. I wanted to follow up a little bit, and it's not with you, but I've looked at the statute, and I'm trying to figure historically where that came from, because it doesn't make a lot of sense why we would want to have someone have to have their weapon displayed and see whether it's loaded or unloaded when you have a valid license. I have spoken with some of the state police, and I know the practice in this building is asking for the permit as compared to looking at the weapon.
Right.
And it just seems, safety-wise, I agree with you, Mr. Hall, it does not seem like that is the best way to handle these situations. So, and Jeff, I know I didn't ask you this, but I know we talked about this, but did you see anything historically as to why that came about?
No, I did not.
Okay. Mr. Sterik, I know that you've kept up pretty well on issues. Could you give us any perspective on history as to why they would want it to have the inspection versus just the actual?
Yes. Again, for the record, Kevin Sterik, Oregon Farms Federation. My guess is that this statute, once again, predates the liberalization of the CHL law. And what you said and what Mr. Hall said is exactly the point for us, is that it's a really unwise thing for people to be handling firearms, right. And particularly in this building, I've been asked for a CHL. I'm walking into a building with 25, 30 people. If everyone's going to have their guns taken out, and since it's perfectly legal, as you pointed out, I can only guess that, as with one of the other statutes we talked about, it was never addressed when CHLs were made more available in 89.
Right. Okay. All right, I appreciate that for the record. Any other questions? Got some puzzled looks, but no.
Oh, I was looking for the materials in OLIS. Will those be loaded later?
Have we received them?
Yeah, which materials?
He was just referencing that he had provided materials, including a video, and I'm not.
I had emailed written testimony to the administrator of this committee.
And when did you do that?
On Monday evening.
That should have been loaded in by now. If it's not, thank you for clarifying that. We'll make certain we'll see where it's at. So thank you all very much. Let me ask if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 173. Now, this one is scheduled. All of these are just scheduled for public hearing. This one is will be wanting to, I think, reschedule for a work session. I'm not sure why this is currently the state of the law, but it seems to me for safety reasons, this is a prudent thing to be doing. So with that, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 173. And Senator Knope, I've been waiting to see if we could get one other person that's supposed to be coming forward, I thought, on this. But I'm going to go ahead and open up Senate Bill 636 is the one you're here on. So we're going to open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 636. And Jeff, give us the overview, please.
Certainly, Chair Brzozinski and members of the committee. Senate Bill 636 comes to us from Senator Knope and Senator Boqvist. The bill reduces the required age for a concealed handgun license applicant to 18 years of age if the applicant is a service member.
Okay.
With no amendments.
Now, I just noticed that was one of the bills that Senator Boqvist was listed that he wanted to testify, but then he waived his testimony, so I apologize for having you wait.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. May I have my legislative director join me?
Yes, you may.
All right. Thank you, sir. Chair Brzozinski and members of the committee, I'm State Senator Tim Knope, Senate District 27, which includes Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River, here today testifying in support of Senate Bill 636. We have 28 co-sponsors of this legislation, and it's really quite simple. And this past interim, a constituent approached me and indicated that we have many servicemen and women who are 18 years of age. They can fight for their country. They can be injured. They can die for their country. They handle weapons anywhere from handguns to rocket-propelled grenades and who knows what else. And yet, by Oregon law, they can't have a concealed handgun license, and obviously you know that you have to be 21 years of age in order to have a handgun license, and it just seemed reasonable that these are some of the most trained people with all kinds of weapons, that they be allowed, because of that training, to have a concealed handgun license, where obviously other citizens, 18 to 21, perhaps do not have that kind of training. And so I just felt like that this was important to bring forward to the legislature to for consideration, because I think it honors the service members that we have in our society who are young, who are probably on their own and serving their country for us. And I just thought it was reasonable to allow them to have a concealed handgun license. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, or you can hear from my esteemed legislative director.
I think we should hear from your esteemed legislative director.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Reagan Canope, and I'm the legislative director for Senator Tim Canope, here to testify on Senate Bill 636. I believe I may be the constituent that you had noted that suggested the introduction of this bill. I think it's important to honor our servicemen and women. This bill allows a service member who is 18 to 21 to be eligible to apply for CHL, and still requires that the service member demonstrate competence with a handgun in accordance with Oregon concealed handgun law. It creates the opportunity for a young service member to apply for that concealed handgun license if they choose, in compliance with current law. So that's all. And I can take any questions if you have any.
All righty. Thank you very much. Questions? This is your opportunity to make a verdict.
Are you aware of what the requirements are for a concealed handgun license, and that there's actually no proficiency training required?
I know there's some outlined in Oregon statute, Chair Przanski, Senator Burdick, and I believe that local counties do have sometimes have those requirements. Deschutes County is one, and I believe Linn County is also some. So my assumption is that if the state doesn't require them, that the local counties, then many of them would.
Actually, the state requires sheriffs to issue the permit, and the training requirement can be met by an online course without any proficiency whatsoever required.
Chair Przanski, if I might add to that, Senator Burdick, I have a CHL, and I think the when we decided, actually my wife and I don't want to out her, but she also went with me to the course, and I think we attended a four-hour course, and you are correct. You don't have to do that course live. You can do that as an online course. But for service members, that's probably more appropriate, quite frankly, than with the public at large because of all the training that they've been through. But the course that we went through was, I think, pretty significant in that it went through several hours of both safety training, handling different types of weapons, and then, of course, your legal obligation as well. And so I thought the course was pretty thorough, but you're right, it doesn't actually involve live firearms training or shooting. But we have a great range, actually a couple of them in Central Oregon, that we've availed ourselves to. So we've taken advantage of that training as well. But I think for a service member, they've really had live firearm training. So that's one of the reasons I felt comfortable bringing this bill forward, based on their age and also their training as well.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, go ahead.
To follow up, first of all, I commend you for going above and beyond. I think it's really important for people who carry these loaded weapons around in public at least know how to use them. And I guess my question would be, if someone enters the service, they are probably, I don't think they can enter the service before 18. I may be wrong. So you potentially could be issuing one of these to someone who has had no training. In other words, it sounds to me like they'd be eligible the day they enter the service. And I'm also not aware, Mr. Chair, and maybe you could enlighten me, I'm not sure at what point in training, in basic training or whatever, firearms proficiency is taught, or whether it's even taught to everyone. I just don't know that.
I couldn't help you with that.
Chair Przanski, Senator Burdick, I believe in basic training, everyone is trained, but I and this is anecdotal on my part, but the people that I've seen go into the service almost always have had some sort of firearms training. They either came out of junior ROTC or they are hunters and have hunted probably most of their lives with their moms and dads, and I think obviously are very patriotic and feel the really the obligation to serve their country. And so in a lot of cases they've already had that firearms training, and I can't obviously think of an instance that I'm aware of where I know of somebody who's joined this service. I'm trying to think back of kids that I've met along the way, but I can't think of any that haven't had that type of training before they even go into the service with all kinds of rifles and handguns as well.
Yeah, and Reagan, is your current situation, looking at what the definition is, are you currently a member of either one of the reserves or on the National Guard?
Chair Przanski, I am not.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. So, Roger, you were signed up or wanting to give testimony on 636.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of this committee. I'm here, and Roger Beyer, and here for the NRA. I'd like to testify in support of Senate Bill 636. We believe this is also an appropriate bill. To get to Senator Burdick's question, I guess, about whether or not a person could just enter the military and then be eligible for this concealed handgun license, I think the answer to that is in the bill. Subsection 1FE, 1F says that you have to demonstrate competence with handgun with any of the following. Under sub E, it said presents evidence of equivalent experience with a handgun through participation in organized shooting competition or military service. So the person, by being enrolled in the military, would not be allowed to be able to get that. They would have to be able to show they've had the training via military service. So, and the training has to be equivalent to what subject through A through D and E above. So therefore, it would not just be a matter, as I read the bill, signing up for the service and be eligible to get the concealed handgun license. You'd have to have some sort of training via your military service. So with that, Mr. Chair, we just think it's appropriate, as you heard from the good senator who brought the bill forward, that these citizens are, you know, they're trained, they are able to, you know, defend our country with a weapon. We think it's appropriate they'd be able to carry a concealed handgun license or carry a concealed handgun while they're in the state of Oregon. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Roger, do you know about other states, what other states provide for, if any, for this type of provision? I'm not sure what I know. Each state has different requirements as to age for getting concealed weapons. I'm just wondering if NRA has any data that maybe you could get to us to just kind of show us how other states have handled this.
Mr. Chair, I don't have that on top of my head. Would be happy to ask and check and see if they have some sort of a database that we could provide to the committee to answer that question. Obviously, as you know, many their states range from, you know, anyone open or carry for any legal owner of a weapon to no concealed handgun licenses at all. So it's going to vary greatly between those two elements.
No, I appreciate that. I understand. But I think this is, let's say, first impression for this committee. I just don't remember this ever being a bill to consider, so it would be nice to have a little bit more background.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
I looked over this section you were talking about, Mr. Beyer, and basically this bill doesn't change the requirements for getting a concealed handgun license. you can still get it from an online course. There are no additional requirements for the under 18, at least not that I'm seeing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, you are correct. The bill does not change that, but it doesn't. What it doesn't say is that just because you are enrolled in the military, you would then be eligible for concealed handgun license. You would have to, as in demonstrated under sub F on line 19, demonstrate competence with a handgun by any of the following, and one of those following is training in the military. So you could still, the 18-year-old person could still do any of the A through E above, or A through D, but E allows their training as a military to fulfill that requirement.
Well, that's correct, but if they haven't had training the way this is written, it says all they have to do is being a service member at least 18 years of age. Either one of these requirements would qualify them. They don't have to have military training, according to the way this is worded.
Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, I guess I'll have to reread the statute, but my understanding is as I read it, would be under current law, the person has to be at least 21 years of age and complete a competency through under sub F.
Under one of those.
But under this, one of those.
This bill changes nothing in the existing law, except the only thing in bold is the person is a service member at least 18 years of age. So unless there's something else in bold, the existing statute would apply. And so they could just the day they sign up for the service, they could take an online course and get a concealed handgun license.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burke, you are correct. Absolutely. They could still do their training via any of those categories. My point is they would still have to do training via one of those categories. Right. Just being in the military does not substitute for the training. If they are in the military, they would have to either do one of those categories above or have training in the military, one or the other.
Correct. But that means that they wouldn't necessarily have to be proficient with a firearm.
As current law is today, yes, you are correct.
Okay. All right. Any other comments? Stay where you're at, please, Roger. I'm going to go ahead and let me just ask real quick, was there anyone else who wanted to testify on 636? Not seeing, we'll close that public hearing. I'm going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing on Senate Bill 299.
Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 299 comes to us from Senator Farioli. The bill allows an Oregon resident to purchase or otherwise obtain a long gun for transport into Oregon from any state, provided that the purchase or transfer is conducted in person. There are no amendments to this bill.
All right. So, Roger, since you're signed up, I want to just let you stay there and not have to...
I need to get my file, Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay. You got to do it anyway. Okay. And just for the record, Senator Farioli is the sponsor of this bill. He has told us through staff that he would like to give testimony, but he's not going to be available until maybe as late as 9:30 or later. So we may not be able to take his testimony because I expect that we're going to be concluding our work before then. But I wanted to go ahead and get that on the record, and we'll get his testimony submitted in writing if he's not able to be here in person. Roger, when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer here representing the NRA. On Senate Bill 299, which Senator Farioli introduced for us. Senate Bill 299 provides that the contiguous states for the transfer of long guns would be all the states of the United States. Long gun transfers currently are allowed in 40 states in this manner. Originally, the Federal Gun Control Act of 1968 banned the interstate sale of firearms, but it contained an exception for long gun transactions occurring between federal licensed dealers and residents of contiguous states. The Firearm Owners Protection Act of 1986, however, removed both the contiguous states limitation and the requirement that the purchaser's state of residence specifically authorize the purchase. Now, interstate sales of rifles and shotguns can occur between FFLs and residents of any state as long as the sale, delivery, and receipt fully comply with the legal conditions of sale in both states. So therefore, and a number of states have patterned their laws after the original act, no longer allowed FFLs, but they amended their laws after the 1986 amendments to allow over-counter transfers to residents of any state. This bill would simply bring Oregon into that 40 states and allow us to be the 41st states, which would allow transfers between any of the states, not just those touching our borders. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions if I can, but we believe this is a appropriate law and would ask your support.
All right, questions? Roger, can you just walk us through if someone, let's say, from New York State had a long gun that they put up and someone in Oregon wanted to purchase that, what would be the steps that would be taken or required?
Mr. Chair, under current law, if a person in New York advertised a gun for sale, wants to sell a gun, and it needs to be shipped, it would have to go through an FFL.
Okay.
That is the only way it can happen. This bill would not change that. My understanding is this can only happen through federal firearms dealers. If you are in for other states, the transfers have to go through federal firearms dealers.
All right. So I want to get this on the record as to exactly what would happen. So my understanding is that if there was a consummation of the deal, the weapon would be shipped or delivered to an FFL in this state, and then the individual who is the purchaser would have to go through the current requirement of the background check, et cetera, or that may have been already done before they even shipped the weapon just to make certain that the person was going to be qualified?
Mr. Chair, that is already the law. You can purchase a gun from a person in another state, but that gun has to be shipped to an FFL in this state, and then the purchaser has to go to that FFL to retrieve the gun and go through a background check. That's already the law. This would allow me, if I'm in one of the other 40 states, to go to the counter and buy a gun there, or vice versa.
Okay, that's not how I read that.
I don't understand. I don't understand what would change, Mr. Chair.
Roger, clarify that. It sounds like if you go to one of these other states, in the sense of you are present let's just say New York State is one of those states that allows for, as within the 40 states, you can have the ability to purchase in person in that state, and then I'm assuming at that point then you are going to move the gun back however you're going to.
Mr. Chair, that is my understanding, yes. Is that currently I can go to Washington State, and right. I can buy a long gun over the counter at an FFL dealer. This would allow me to go to Montana and do the same thing, or one of the other 40 states that would allow that transaction.
Okay. And so depending on what those states, whether they have background check requirements or not, would be the, depending on which state you go to, you may have to have a background check. In some states you wouldn't.
Mr. Chair, all states by federal law require a background check by FFL, and this is only for FFL dealers.
Okay. Just want to put that, I want to make sure that's on the record, because said earlier, I was confusing, so I just want to make sure we got that correct.
Well, also for the record, Mr. Chair, if you went to Montana and bought it from a private seller who is not required to have a background check, would this bill allow you to do that?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding this bill would not change that transaction whatsoever.
So you'd still be able to buy it from a private seller without a background check?
I would like to check to make sure, but I don't know. This bill doesn't speak to that issue, is my understanding.
Come on up. I think just make sure we got information on the record.
Once again, Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. No, it is unlawful to purchase a firearm in another state from a private party anywhere in the country. If I purchase a gun from a person in Montana, he still must ship that gun to a dealer in Oregon where I undergo the background check. There's no provision for a background check prior to the transaction taking place. So, for example, if somebody in Montana had a firearm that I wanted, there would be no way I could be pre-cleared for that firearm. They cannot conduct the background check until I am in the store and the firearm is present. But it is unlawful to purchase a firearm in another state. A firearm cannot cross state lines. The only exception to that is if somebody wills it to a person, and after the person dies, then the firearm can be transferred without a background check, but there are no other exceptions, not for law enforcement, not for family, for nobody.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Councilman Gelson.
I have a basic question. If I live in Indiana and I move to Oregon,
can I bring my firearms with me when I move if I already own?
Yeah. Yes, Senator.
So this is just about when you when I live here and I go someplace else to purchase them.
What it means is that, you see, currently you can go to any other state and purchase a long gun if the state doesn't prohibit it. But Oregon law, this is another one of those antiquated statutes, says you can only do it in these listed states. This would just say I'd have to comply with every other federal law. I can just do it in states in addition to these. But I can't do it under any conditions without a background check. I can't buy it from a private party. I can't buy it from a dealer. Every single state for every single transaction requires a background check if you're crossing state lines with that firearm.
Yes.
So the process would be if you wanted a gun in Montana, you'd have to get it from a Montana gun dealer, or could you have them ship it to Oregon and...
Yes. The process is the owner of the firearm ships it to a dealer here in Oregon. Then the background check is run. Obviously, where the problems come in is if there's one of the many failures of our background check, now the dealer has a gun and there's enormous complications over who owns the gun. But no, I cannot take possession of it under any other circumstances unless it is sent to a dealer in the state and I am subjected to a background check.
So, Mr. Chair, so how are these online transactions taking place?
They're taking place exactly the same way. It's no different than if I advertised a firearm in the nickel ads or if I posted a sign with a photograph of a gun at my gun club. If the gun is coming from another state, simply because it's been advertised on the internet changes nothing. All it means is I've identified this particular firearm that might not be available here. I make an agreement that I want to purchase the firearm. The owner of the firearm ships it to a dealer here, and I undergo a background check. And so all this talk about internet sales is, frankly, it's simply false. There is no difference of any kind when I buy a gun on the internet, except for the fact that there's a larger pool of devices available, just like, you know, 30 years ago, there were fewer dating services. Now there's a million of them. But the fact is that the process is exactly the same. All it means is that something that I might have trouble finding here, because there's only one of, is available to me with all of the same background checks and restrictions as if I purchased it under any other circumstances.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So right now, if you find a gun on the internet that's from Montana, you can't legally buy it?
You can't legally buy it unless it's shipped to an FFL, a federally licensed dealer in Oregon.
So you can buy it. So what would the bill change?
The bill would simply change the fact that right now, if I am personally in another state, I travel, for example, I can drive to Idaho now, purchase a long gun from a dealer with a background check conducted in Idaho, exactly like our background checks are. The only difference would be that in some of these states, they contact the feds directly instead of contacting the state police and being charged an extra $10 to contact the feds. I could purchase that firearm for my own possession in a face-to-face transaction after undergoing a background check. Our law says you can only do it in California, Idaho, Nevada, and Washington. And why it says that, I have no idea, because the feds consider contiguous states everything, all of the states. And so all this bill is doing is recognizing what federal law already says, that if, for example, I fortunately haven't been in New York in a long time, but they may very well have a prohibition on a non-resident purchasing a long gun in New York. No one can purchase a handgun there. But that would be their prohibition. But in any other state that just followed federal law, if I arrived there and I was buying the gun for myself and passed the background check, I could take possession of it in states other than the few listed in the current statute.
All right. Any other questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you all very much. So is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 299? I'm not seeing one. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing. And we're going to reopen up Senate Bill 170 for additional testimony. Go ahead and give us the summary on that one, please, Jeff.
Certainly. Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 170 comes to us from Senator Boquist. The bill requires school districts to provide age-appropriate firearm safety courses. It states that the courses must be a minimum of 1 hour for students in kindergarten through fifth grade and a minimum of 2 hours for grades 6 through 12. There are no amendments to this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. Kevin, you're listed on this one, so why don't you go ahead and come on back up. You're the only other person I had that wanted to give testimony on this bill.
Can I just stay here?
I think the next one you can, because I'm going to call 385 up. I'm going to kind of back him up, because now we have time to actually take up this new amendment.
Okay. For the record, again, Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. I'm disappointed that Ms. McKinley couldn't be here to talk about this, because she's quite an accomplished young lady. She's also started arranging for these classes to take place, and there are at least two classes that she's already arranged that I'm aware of. And clearly, I think it's important. Every time there's an accident or misuse of a firearm by a young person, what we hear from the opponents of firearms ownership is that we simply have to give up more rights. And what she's proposing here is that instead of promoting fear and ignorance, that we simply promote the kind of education and knowledge that every young person should have. I had nothing to do with the construction of this bill. I knew she was doing it because she told me. I met her when she was a very young girl, and I gave a class to her family. I would say this, though, as a firearms instructor and as one of the instructors who will be doing some of the classes she's put together, we can simplify this tremendously. When I do a firearms class, which I do once a month at my gun club and a couple of times a month in other facilities, it's an all-day event. It includes live fire. It includes over an hour of instructions on the use of force, the legal responsibilities, and a whole range of things. That's not what we need to do here. What we need to do is teach young people how to not hurt themselves. And in the class that my son and I have put together for these events that Ms. McKinley has put together, I'm quite confident that we can transfer that information in a half an hour. We're not teaching people how to shoot. We're not teaching people how to conduct competition or combat. What we're teaching people how to do is deal with a firearm that they come across no matter what their experience has been. So, for example, one of the things that we would teach people, young people, is if they are absolutely forced to handle a firearm because they may have to safeguard it from some younger person, how to handle it in a way that they cannot possibly injure somebody. And it doesn't take that long to do it. We've even removed one of the elements of the class where we teach that you always know your target and what's behind it, because there won't be a target, that the thing will be pointed in a safe direction and somebody will contact an adult or the authorities or police. So, for example, a young person finds a gun at a school. We teach them, don't touch it, get somebody else to get a principal. We do not want a young person picking up a gun in school. But I do think that it is essential that young people understand how to be safe around something they may very likely come in contact with. And with all the other things that we mandate for young people in our schools, this is something that I would hope we would all agree with, irrespective of your position on firearms ownership, the recognition that at least for now, there are still legally available guns and there are illegally available guns. And if we can prevent somebody from doing something stupid because they had no idea that if you remove the magazine from a semi-automatic pistol, it could still be around in the chamber, then I think this would be well worth it, and I'd be hard-pressed to find someone who would be opposed to the idea. In its form, I think it's overly complicated. I don't think we need to take as much time as the bill calls for. But a simplified version of an instructor comes in, can do this for any age kid in a half an hour, that is something I'd urge you to look at.
Okay. Questions? Stay there. All right. Let me just see if anyone else wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 170. Not seeing anyone. We'll close that public hearing. We're going to open up a public hearing now on Senate Bill 385.
Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 385 comes to us from the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. The bill allows a justice and municipal court, adds the justice and municipal court to the definition of court facility where firearms and other weapons are prohibited absent specific circumstances. It amends language concerning prohibitive knives to include pocket knives and authorizes municipal and justice court judges to establish procedures regulating the possession of firearms and other weapons in court facilities. We do have a number of amendments on this bill. We have a proposed dash one that states that in a shared court facility, the order, policy, or procedure of the presiding court judge takes precedence over that of the municipal court judge or justice of the peace. We have dash four amendments that we received at 5:30 yesterday. Those amendments add juvenile courts and justice of the peace to the definition. They restrict the prohibition to the area where the court conducts business and during hours of business, and they make the offense a Class C felony. We also received dash five amendments while we were on the dais today that have been posted as of 8:36. Those amendments make it a Class C felony and also contain the hours restriction that are in the dash four amendments.
Okay. So just for logistics, the dash fives, I believe we can, one, take testimony on those and discuss them in our Q&A. This bill, just like the others, are not set for public hearing, work session at this point. So we should not have a problem with that concern as to working the bill before it's set for an hour. So let me go ahead and get Patrick Singh to come on up. And those are the only two individuals I have signed up that want to give testimony. Is there anyone else? I see Dave Factor in the room. I don't know if you wanted to come up on behalf of the court. And if you do, please do so. And okay. All right. No, so this is what we're, counsel has corrected me. The dash five have components that are in the dash four. Right. The dash four we can, in fact, discussion and testimony on because we've passed the hour, which was going to be somewhere around 9 o'clock or 9:05. So even though we're not going to directly talk about the dash fives, they were indirectly be discussed, at least the issues, because okay. They're in the dash fours.
Mr. Chair, real quick, I was the author of dash five because I did not see something that met my concerns on posted for an amendment. So we, you know, that doesn't necessarily have to.
Yeah. So
but I see the dash fours now. So I didn't last night. So.
Okay. So at this point, we're here to take testimony. Let's see. I think to do this, let's see, in the order that we have, I'm going to ask Patrick to go first, and then we'll do Kevin, and then Dave Factor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Singham with the Association of Oregon Counties. We brought this bill forward with the judges, municipal and justices of the peace judges. So we're in support of the bill. We have worked with OJD, Mr. Starrett, Senator Beyer, since the first hearing on this bill on a couple of amendments. We do support the dash ones, which I believe OJD introduced, which would give the presiding judges of circuit court jurisdiction if there's a shared facility with one of the local courts. That is definitely something we support. And then two things that the dash fours do. One is it adds juvenile and probate courts to the list of local courts. Those would be the seven counties that where the elected county chair of the county commission is actually a county judge, and they have probate and juvenile authority. Most of those courts meet in the circuit court courthouse. However, there are a few where they meet outside of the courthouse in other buildings. Also, the addressing the concerns from Mr. Starrett and Senator Beyer, restricting the hours and the jurisdiction of the judge to the operating hours of the court and the areas where the court operates. And then the Class C felony is consistent with the current law for a court facility, but it just creates a definition for a local court facility. Happy to answer any questions.
All right. Kevin, why don't you go next?
Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. As you know, members of the committee, my concern when I testified against this previously was twofold. One, that municipal courts are frequently used for other purposes, and I was afraid that these rooms would be completely off limits to firearms owners even when they weren't being used as courts. And the other one, as I discussed, was that my position is, and I believe the court's position is that the judges in these courts currently have the authority to do this. And so while with the amendments it addresses my concern about where and when the rooms are used, and I'm totally in support of that, I still think it's unnecessary and, frankly, could have been solved with an email to the judges. But with the amendments, it addresses my concern about making a room off limits at a time when no court action was taking place.
Okay. So Patrick said dash ones and dash fours is what the proponents are supporting, and you're neutral for both the ones and the fours?
We had requested the fives. It looks to me like everything that is in the fives was in theirs, and so
okay.
I'm not going to discuss the penalties that are involved, but I think those are across other courts as well. But if I don't have to worry about somebody innocently going to a city council meeting and suddenly finding themselves committing a felony because the court meets there one day a week, that would address our concerns.
Okay, thank you. Dave?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Factor, staff counsel with the Oregon Judicial Department. We are neutral on the bill as introduced. We did propose the dash one amendments to ensure that in those jurisdictions where the local courts, municipal courts, justice courts, and now the county probate and juvenile courts share a facility with the circuit courts, that those circuit court orders entered by the presiding judge sort of take precedence, so there's not conflicting orders about the operation and possession of weapons in those facilities. So having seen the dash fours this morning, just want to make sure that the addition of the juvenile and probate court county courts doesn't conflict with the dash ones, and so there'll be a conforming amendment related to that.
Okay. Well, we don't have all the paperwork to even consider doing a work session on the bill today. Because the fours did come in late, they have not been processed through the fiscal office or the revenue office. So we'll check and confirm that. Let me ask if there's any questions for anyone on the panel. All right, looks like we're off on that. All right, thank you all very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 385? Not seeing anyone coming forward. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 385. And at this point, I believe we've got through everything. Just want to confirm. So, Jeff, anything that you see that we need to do?
Nope.
Yeah, and I was kind of waiting to see if Senator Farrion was able to make it into the room, so we'll just get word to him that if he wants to submit written testimony, that he can do that.
We've been talking with his office. He said as long as the NRA was here, he was okay.
Oh, okay. All right. So with that, we're going to go ahead and adjourn, and my understanding, we're set for tomorrow at 8 o'clock. So thank you all very much.